Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson on 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
In the Bet365 Command Center, greetings and salutations. Good evening to you. Welcome to Beyond the Bricks. My name is Jake Query, and Beyond the Bricks, of course, is our look at some of the personalities of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, as told often through their own words. Mike Thompson is typically the man who puts together the audio that you hear on this program, and we have a lot of fun doing it, but we're going to do something a little bit different tonight. In addition to doing this program, I also host an afternoon radio show from noon until 3 on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan in Indianapolis, and in that capacity, leading up to the 108th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race during practice days, had the opportunity, along with my co-host Jimmy Cook, to interview two of the biggest names in Indy 500 history. And we'll begin with the first. He literally needs no introduction, but I'll do it nonetheless. The 1969 winner, Mario Andretti.
The race that sticks in your mind the most that was not 1969 when you won here was which one?
Well, the one that comes to mind clearly and immediately is 1987, driving for Newman Haas. And with the Lola I had, my engineer was Adrian Newey, whom I consider one of the top ever, you know, as far as really understanding every aspect of a race car, suspension dynamics, aerodynamics. And anyway, if you look at the record, I was pretty much quickest every single day and on the track, on pole. And I think I led 171 of 178 laps that I was in. 1.5 lap lead on Al Unser and
Roberto Guerrero would have been running up there, right?
Yeah. But again, you know, I dropped the valve. I was, you know, really trying to run conservative on the revs, and that's what bit me. Because unbeknownst to me, I was running in the bad harmonics of the engine. You know, if I would have been pushed for the lead or something, it would have been better. You know, because I needed to be like 400 revs more, and that's against everything everybody's been telling me. You know, the car was, I was cruising home. The car was so good throughout the run, you know, from full tanks to empty. You know, I never had a car that stayed, you know, neutral to me, and I could really get after it and very easily. So, again, that was the biggest disappointment because that race was totally in my pocket.
So, in other words, the car that year, if it was a racehorse, it's saying, no, let's go more. I got more here, right? Is that basically what happened?
Oh, I had more, yeah. I didn't need it.
Here's the thing. That has to be one of the few times where Mario Andretti actually said, I'm backing off, right?
Because I didn't have to. I didn't have to run 100%, obviously, and there's no better position to be in. You know, at the time, the car was really working under me. Like I said earlier, you know, we were talking about it. I said, starting that race, something very, very rare that you could think, you know, today they have to beat me. In other words, if the car fails me, you know, that's the only way they can beat me. That's how confident I was, you know, with that, which is rare, rare, rare. To answer your question, that's the one.
Mario, during the break, I've gotten all kinds of messages from one of my oldest brothers who is going to turn 68 this year. He remembers you coming to, or he went to grade school, St. Jude, and speaking to him when you were a rookie on the circuit, to cousins of mine that are texting in. I remember growing up because of you, rooting for the Andretti family in any capacity, and this circuit and the speedway itself meaning so much to me and my family because of you. That's generation on generation because of what you've done for the sport and what Andretti Racing has done for the sport. What does that mean to you to be able to put that in perspective, knowing decade after decade there's still people that, because of your impact, love this sport so much?
Look at it this way. That's the highest compliment that I could have. And then on the other side, it's my fault if you, follow this. But I'll take that. And, you know, I mean, again, you know, if all I know is what it means, what it has meant to my family on both sides. Aldo and I used to say, you know, that we're the ones that started this mess, you know. And then as a family, look at 1991, 1992, there were four of us that qualify for this race, you know.
Jeff, Michael, John, Mario, right?
Yeah, that's it. Jeff, Michael, John. And the pride is there for sure. And and it continues. I mean, look at the way Michael now, you know, he's been, the last few years, been entering, you know, four, five, six entries, you know, for this race. So, and, you know, he was another one that was denied because of a reliability factor. You know, he dominated this race, you know.
Boy, that 92 race.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, he had more of those. But I keep telling Michael, I said, both you and I were born too early, I said, because the style of driving for us would have been today, because we were just flat out from the word go, you know, so we didn't have much patience. And with the reliability of today's engines, today's cars, I mean, it would have paid off for us, you know, much more than it did then. And so, but it is what it is. It's still, you know, I look back at all the laps that I, you know, I led more laps at all but one of the four-time winners, you know, so that's my satisfaction ultimately, that I got satisfaction out of every race that I entered here, so that's what I got to go with.
But you won everything. I mean, you're a Formula One world champion. You've done everything around the world, and your name is undoubtedly, and I've said this to you 50 times probably, but your name is the most famous race car driver of all time. I mean, it has become a euphemism for speed. So does the fact that you are the Indianapolis 500 champion, is that the thing that you put as the top of your pedestal?
Well, it's certainly at the top, but I mean, that year I won national championship as well. You know, I look a lot more premium at the overall season.
Right.
You know, of course, the star of the season was Indy. You know, but, you know, like in 69 with that championship, I won races, you know, super speedway, short oval, on the dirt even, which counted for the points. I won even Pikes Peak, and I won road course. And that was the ultimate satisfaction for me to be able to, you know, put my mark in there in all the different aspects of that season, which was extremely versatile, you know. So that's what I got my ultimate satisfaction as a driver.
For those that are unaware, Mario Andretti is our guest here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Andretti Global is the name of the team that your son owns, Michael Andretti, formerly Andretti Autosport. Andretti Global, of course, because the team is going exactly that with the aspirations of Formula One. And I know that you have, you know, championed that as well to get that team into Formula One, and yet for whatever reason it is being blocked, I'll say, for lack of a better phrase. What is your understanding as to why that entry has not yet been allowed, and where do things stand?
Well, you know, in a short, we don't totally understand exactly why. We think we know, but we're not being told directly, except that you know, they keep saying that, we don't bring value or something like that to the series. But we're you know, we're going flat out, you know, in preparing. So, you know, once we're given the green light, you know, we don't want to start from scratch. I mean, that Michael, you know, and his partners, I mean, they have the faith that the reason will prevail ultimately. And so they have a facility in England already all set to go. And we have a lot of progress. So, in other words, the objective is to be on the grid in 2026 with the new rules, and you know, once we're given the go, we'll be there.
Is it a bias against having an American team, or is it a bias against having the Andretti name? I can't imagine why that would be, but what would your gut tell you?
I'm telling you, Jake, if if I really had a clear vision, I mean, a clear understanding, what was the issue? Because we comply with every aspect of the technical side, satisfy the FIA, and so on the commercial side, all of a sudden, that's where, and we're ready to obviously go with whatever is on the so-called Concord Agreement, you know, and if they want to change the rules, that's our issue. complying with everything that's put in front of us. So I don't know what else to do.
What is one thing that throughout your entire career you're surprised you don't get asked about more often?
Why are you at so many races?
Because you still want to get in the car, right? Why are you?
You know what? I just keep dreaming about being in a race car.
You miss it?
Oh, heck. I'm dealing with it, you know, and that was my biggest fear when I, you know, made a decision to retire, because I felt that I didn't want to overstay. I wanted to have, a positive memory of my, you know, last days as the active driver. And I think I accomplished that. Like my wife always said, you know, I hope you can readjust to that. And my body actually acted kind of strange, because a professor there actually was interested in what was happening to me. He said, I think your body has been living for so long, most of your life on adrenaline, that now it thinks that you're dead.
so you got to go find new adrenaline,
then,
right?
You know, when I first got in a race car again in 2003, when I got upside down here, I thought I died and went to heaven, you know, because, you know, all of a sudden I was in my element. You know, it's amazing how that reacted on me, but it was a portion of my life that really huge change, but I'm learning to deal with it. But I feel that because of Michael being involved, you know, all the disciplines, you know, I feel that when I go to a racetrack, I have a home. And that's why, you know, if I go to a Formula One race, I don't have a home yet. So I want to have a home again. And that's part of it. That's what satisfies me.
You know, Mario, you were saying in the break, we were sitting here chatting, and you were saying, you try just not to dwell on bad things. You try not to have a bad day, right? You have this glow about you. But yet, the reality is, Mario Andretti, that the last handful of years, you know, I would imagine have tested that. I mean, I know family is very important to you. And, you know, we know that you lost your nephew, John, and your wife, and your brother, Aldo. Were there times where it has been tough and where you have had to truly dig deep to continue the same optimism and faith?
Yes, I mean, it's, yeah, indeed. I mean, again, and my sister as well, you know. So, there was a terrible period, of course. But these are the things that in life you cannot control, obviously. But you cannot be positive about that, you know. But it's part of life, and you have to accept those moments, you know. The things that I feel that I can control, I just try to stay on the positive side, for sure.
And I would imagine, you know, you're, and even as a racer, I think you were pretty scrupulous and true to staying towards your faith and your belief in that, which obviously has to have carried you for the last handful of years.
No question. No question about it. I never felt that I did it alone. I always felt that I had some help. We had an uncle priest on my side, and I know that he looked after me for so long, and he missed up a little bit on my brother, but something was working for me, and again, I take nothing for granted there.
You go back and you think about your father, and I love, one of the things I love about you, Mario Andretti, is when you post each year, because I can see what it means to you, the celebration of the anniversary of when you became a legalized citizen, right? Yes. And when you were, how old when you moved from Italy?
When we left Italy, I was 15.
Okay.
When we arrived in the States, 15.
And if I'm not mistaken, your dad didn't necessarily want you and your twin brother Aldo racing at first, right?
That was a father's, you know, the sport was obviously had so many fatalities.
Right.
That's all that he knew. He was not a race fan. And you know, he felt that, you know, kids, be real. You know, they're going to come home in a body bag, you know, from one of the races. So, but, you know, he came around and he was the biggest fan and everything. Then, later, after that, then he said, why aren't you winning every race? You know what I mean? he didn't understand that part either.
When was the moment that you realized that you kind of had the epiphany that your father had given his approval to your career?
Well, actually, yeah, I was in Trenton, New Jersey when I got my first ride in a Champ car. Very first time. And first time I was on a mile track with a roadster, 1964, and he was there, and I finished 11th, and I thought that was really a good start for me. And he was disappointed. He thought that I should have done a lot better. You know, so you could see that. God bless him. He didn't,
so Dad had a little racer really, in him too, right?
Yeah, but he didn't really understand, you know, that this is not a simple business, you know. But that was that. And like I said, once he realized that that's how we, Aldo and I were all in, then obviously then he became a big fan.
You mentioned your curiosity of what life would be like after racing and into retirement. For drivers that get close to that point, or for people in general, that can be a tough transition, what advice would you give them when they reach that point where something you've done maybe your whole life has ended, but it does open up a new chapter as well, and that can be scary?
Well, that's true. I mean, it's just, this is such a personal thing, you know, yeah. Because, you know, I give an example. I think Michael, for instance, you know, he was at the top of his game as a driver, and he looked at the business side of it. You know, he thought, you know, because that could be for a long, long time. And he became a car owner immediately, and he's totally happy with that. So we all have different objectives. You know, we all love the sport in different ways. So I don't know what advice that I could really give. Just try to be happy with whatever you pursue, yeah. You know. I know that, again, you know, with me, I stayed in the sport as long as it was anywhere reasonable. I mean, I stayed at the top level until I was 53, but I raced at 24 Hours of Le Mans, the last race, when I was 60, you know. And I would have tried to qualify when I was 63, you know, because Tony Kanaan had, you know, a wrist injury in Japan, and I was filling in for him, you know, in case I would have to qualify. Like, I've had guys qualify for me, Dennis Firestone and Wally Dallenbach qualify for me while I was in Monaco, you know, back in the 70s. So, anyway.
78, right? I think, was that the year that was?
Yeah, but twice they had to qualify for me while I was in Monaco.
In 81, are you still wearing the 81 ring there? Love it. So Mario Andretti wins the race in 1969. You come back in 1981. Everybody knows the story of the controversy with you and Bobby Unser at the end of the race. And Bobby Unser is declared the winner. Then they go back and they say, no, wait a minute, Mario Andretti won. I had posted once on social media and you responded to it. And I'm kicking myself I didn't bring it. When I went to that race, the first race that I attended was 1981. And afterwards, for school, I was in the I would have been in the first grade. And I wrote a paper about the 1981 race, and I said Bobby Unser won the race, but he passed cars when he shouldn't, and that's a no-no, and so Mario Andretti is the winner. And my mom found that initial school report that I wrote and had it framed and laminated for me, and I figured you absolutely would give me an A-plus on that school project, right? Because I said Mario Andretti is the winner of the race.
You're darn right. Well, Jake, I actually, by the rule book, I won that race because they, you know, I was actually the first official winner because I got noticed 5 in the morning when Jim McGee, my chief mechanic, says they penalized Bobby based on the rule book. I mean, even Jim McKay and Jackie Stewart, even when he was passing those cars, 11 cars under the yellow, said, you can't do that. You can't do that. They even knew then. But in those days, you know, today they would give you, you know,
in race penalty, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but in those days, you know, no computer and everything else, you know, they had, as always, traditionally go through the tape. That's why the race was never official until five in the morning. And then it took 6 months, depositions and everything else. And then, you know, the Roger Penske's lawyers, you know, that, you know, got USAC to agree with bringing in 3 outside judges to make a final and a decision. And the final decision was, yes, he did commit the, you know, the infraction, but the penalty is too severe, so they fined him $40,000 and they gave him the race back. But it gets better, and I'll say this. The following year, after the driver's meeting, I raised my hand and I asked Tom Binford, who was the race director, I said, if I pass 11 cars under the yellow, today and cross the finish line first, is the fine still $40,000? He said, oh, no, no, no. I said, so the rule book will apply this year, but it didn't apply last year. And, you know, to his credit, he says, yeah, Mario, I penalized him as a race director. He said, but I was overridden, you know. And so that was the part that I could never accept. That because, you know, I love Bobby, you know, we're good buddies, but, and, you know, I actually, I blame USAC at the time, you know, because they allowed outsiders to come in and determine and change the rule book.
Did it fracture your friendship for a while with Bobby Unser?
Well, he thought that it did because he felt guilty.
Yeah.
But
did he ever ask for the ring back?
Hell no. I mean, I don't care. You know, I don't know if they gave him another one, but I was not going to give the ring back.
And so in the end, obviously, the two of you, you know, take me through the process of, I'll say making up. I mean, maybe that was more on Bobby Unser's end. But, you know, Bobby Unser was such another wonderful personality here, and the loss of Bobby Unser and just... Were you glad that things had been made up by the time that we lost Bobby Unser?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As far as I'm concerned, we definitely... I never blamed him. I just blamed the organization. He did what he could, you know, and Roger did, you know, they were allowed to protest and everything else. I blame USAC as a sanctioning body for allowing that, you know, that was a stain as far as I'm concerned, because if they would have changed the rule book, okay, the following year, all right, if you pass, you know, somebody cross the finish line, okay, $40,000 the fine, you know, then I would have accepted that, but not the same only in that situation. So, I mean, there were examples of Johnny Parsons, you know, so, you know, had the best finish, he passed, it was less of an infraction. The next day, he went from second to seventh, I think. And
I'd pass 22 cars and just pay the $80,000, right?
Yeah.
Call it a day, right?
I'd do that all day.
Okay, lastly, Mario, on this Fast Friday, and watching the speeds right now, Chevrolet 1 through 7 on the speed charts, what are we seeing? What do we anticipate? Just your overall thoughts now down the home stretch here of these practice sessions before qualifying.
Well, you know, it's exciting. Qualifying is one thing. The race is something else, obviously, but nothing like starting up front as far as I'm concerned. And it's amazing now. It's really telling us something that the Chevys at the moment at least seems to have some advantage on the Hondas. I hope we can somehow figure that out.
Would you rather have a little bit extra speed or a car that you can go further on a stint because of fuel efficiency?
Well, I think, again, all of that plays for the long term, for the long race, obviously. You know, just because you're starting up front doesn't mean you're guaranteed to finish there. There are other factors in the race, but from my standpoint, I'll take power and speed anytime.
Every year at Christmas, Mario, and this is Christmas for a lot of people out here, right? I mean, this is Christmas
time. Yeah, for
time.
Sure.
But every year at Christmas, the best tradition, I think, going on social media is you post your Christmas tree, and then you ask people to share theirs. And the thing that I think is so wonderful about it is people share with you their little family tradition or sometimes very modest Christmas trees. And you make every single one of those people feel like gold by simply finding something in their photo that is special.
Keeps me busy. That time we started that, and, you know, we just decided to keep the tradition because it seemed like it caught on somewhat. And if people want to stay in touch in that, you know, fashion, I welcome
it. But do you grasp the warmth it gives people?
You're not kidding. Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, that's to me, that's the ultimate element, you know, of I mean, there's nothing makes you feel better than that, quite honestly.
Then helping people out and making them smile. That's what it's all about, right?
That's
and you continue
about
to do it, which is impressive. Two-time winner of the Indy 500, Mario Andretti, right?
You bet.
1969. Okay. I got to get a picture of the ring, by the way. I do it every year, but I got to get – it's fabulous. Jimmy,
it's awesome.
They presented you the ring. When did they present it?
You got to see. Oh, I got the
ring. Was it the next day?
No, I got it at the banquet, yeah. Yeah, everything. I got the ring.
All right, hold on. I got to get Kurt Darling out of the photo. All right, give me a smile with that 81 there. That is just the best. Mario Andretti. Mario, enjoy it today, all right? And enjoy qualifying as well. Always good to see you.
Thank you.
All right,
thanks
the 1969 and 1981 winner of the Indianapolis 500, Mario Andretti.
Obviously facetious when I say the two-time winner of the Indy 500, but Mario Andretti's chuckle and the ring allow us to continue that conversation about that controversial 1981 finish. The man is an absolute gem and a treasure. He won the race once, twice, if you go with the flippant nature of it. When we come back, another man who joined us this week as well. That conversation with Mario Andretti was on May 17th of 2024. A couple of days later, we talked to another man that won in Indianapolis, but he did so four times. That conversation is next.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Even if you don't have a Kroger store nearby, you can still get Kroger groceries delivered that are guaranteed fresh. Order on the app and your groceries hit the road with prices so low you won't believe the savings. Get $25 off your first two orders, plus unlimited free delivery for $59 a year with a Boost membership. We'll bring all the fresh groceries you need from the store to your door. Kroger, fresh for everyone. $35 minimum order excludes alcohol and gift cards. Offer valid on delivery only with a digital coupon. Restrictions may apply. See site for details.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Bet365 Command Center. Welcome back to Beyond the Bricks. My name is Jake Query, co-host of Query & Company on 93.5, 107.5 The Fan. On that program, in anticipation of the 108th running of the Indianapolis 500, at a practice day, we caught up with four-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, Rick Mears. Here's that conversation.
You are so synonymous with success here, and you kind of owned it. You know, four of them in 12 years speaks for itself. But what is the sentiment or the emotion of Rick Mears still when you walk in here?
First of all, I never believed I'd ever be here. I didn't even think about being here. That was way out of my league. So, you know, when I got the opportunity to start driving Indy cars and end up coming here, I had no idea that would ever happen. So it's just it's almost been one of those fairy tale stories all the way through. But it's just, and now it's home away from home for as many years as we've been coming here. But it's just there's no other place like it. It's really hard to explain. And yeah, it's like with Roger back, when he owned Michigan and two or three racetracks that he owned, and we'd go around and go to those, his home tracks, and they did nothing for him like this place did when he came through the gate here. Always getting me the tools I needed. That's like qualifying here. You know, it's one of the highest pressure pack things you ever do.
And you told me you loved it.
I did, yeah. I do. And because of that pressure, and because it's so difficult, and that's what makes it, more enjoyable and more satisfying if you do well. But, mainly if you're in the hunt for the pole or front row, something like that, that's when the pressure's on. If not, then you can say, okay, I need to get it, a good four laps in, put it in the show, and look toward the race and go on. But if you're with a shot at the pole, front row, then the pressure's there. Well, this team, Team Penske, always gave me the tools needed to put me in the hunt. So I never ran here without the pressure.
Right.
It was constant. But that is really what makes this place, that kind of thing.
Four-time Indy 500 champion Rick Mears is our guest. Rick, for your four Indy 500 wins, three of them you won the pole. Where does the mentality change for a driver having won the pole versus not going into this race? And at what point does the brain shift from, okay, qualifying's done, now it's time to focus on the task at hand?
Yeah, I just looked at two races. I want to win both of them. So I worked, and a lot of times early years especially, I probably worked too hard toward the qualifying and not enough for the race setup, and we'd be okay in qualifying. Then the race start, and 10 laps into the race, I'm yelling, I'm loose, we got to fix it, because I didn't work hard enough, because I was always focused on the qualifying to begin with. But, I learned later on to separate those a little bit more. But once you get through the qualifying, then it's – and qualifying to me was always kind of a payback to the team for all the hard work they do. I loved seeing the smiles on their faces after we laid down some good laps and came in,
Yeah.
That was always very gratifying. But it just – you know, I wanted to win that race. But then also safety-wise, too, there was another factor. You know, if there's a problem in turn one on the start, if I'm on the front row, more than likely I'll miss it unless I caused it. And if I caused it, I deserve to be in it anyway, back, right? But it's just, you know, we're racers, and that's all you want to do is finish up front, no matter what you're in. But you do have to. But in the race, I always felt like, okay, I've got some time to breathe here. You know, and I always spent the first half getting to the second half and working with the team and what the track conditions were, because they were always different every day, you know. And so we started working. I always watched the other guys and started trying to see who was going to be the biggest competitor at the end of the race that I was going to have to deal with. And to have that shootout, so to speak. And of the four wins, that only happened one time. It only boiled down to that one time.
Pretty big one, though, right?
It was Michael in 91, right? It was the most gratifying because of that.
And you know what's interesting about that is in that 91 race, you know, seemingly in the last dash, your car came to you and Michael's seemed to go away, if you will. And I think that I wasn't in the car, obviously, Rick, but it would seem as though you had saved it for the right spot. But how difficult is that for the first 80% to know to not push it so that it's good to go?
To me, it wasn't difficult. It's just common sense kind of feeling to me. You know, I don't want him to know what I have.
Right.
Until it's too late for him to make any more changes after the last stop. And that's basically what we did there, because even after the race it was over, the first comments Michael made was, I don't know where he got all that speed. I haven't seen that speed all day. Well, no, I didn't show him. You know, and it was for a reason. But, you know, like him or whoever it would have been that I'd be watching like that, he had a pretty good little understeer in the car, which is a more solid way to drive it. But it's not the fastest. But it's. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's good. Did you work with Sam Hornish as well? Because I know Elio, obviously, mm-hmm. but Sam Hornish, it jogged my mind right there, Rick, because when I remember Marco Andretti in 06 getting out of the car and saying, where did the speed come from? And so right then I'm thinking, I wonder if it's because Sam Hornish got the trick from Rick Mears, it's because you hadn't seen it all day.
I don't know if he was really planning it that way, but he was a smart racer. You know, and I'm sure he kept a little up his sleeve when he needed to. And because that was, if I'd have shown that speed before the last stop, he'd have taken that push out, or he'd have tried to make a change at the last stop and put a little more front wing in it and make the car a little quicker, which then would have been more difficult for me. But as long as I know if I was in his shoes and I had everybody covered with that balance, I wouldn't risk in the last pit stop to make a change, because you might tip it over and get loose and be worse. So as long as he thought he had everybody handled, he wasn't going to risk making the change. And then, you know, after that last stop, now it's time to go.
I wanted to share with our listeners, Rick Mears is our guest, the four-time winner of the Indianapolis 500. Practice will get underway here, by the way, about 1 o'clock. And I know you've got responsibilities, and I want to go over that with you. But a couple of years ago, we were in Toronto. I wouldn't expect you to remember this. But you were spotting, I believe, for Elio at the time. And I was up with all the spotters in Toronto, and I'm calling the race, and there was a rain delay. So a couple of the spotters said, hey, Jake, start doing trivia for everybody to pass the time. So I asked this trivia question, and I said, who are the only two drivers to win the Indy 500 in three decades? And immediately one of them comes up with Bobby Unser, which is right. And they're throwing out every name possible to try to think of the other, which was you, and you're just standing there. And eventually I said, does anybody want to ask Rick Mears for a hint here? And you had this almost uncomfortable look on your face, and I think your wording was, I don't think it's my job to say, or I'm not eligible to give the answer, because it was you. And that's when I had this epiphany, Rick Mears, that I've always wanted to ask you. Why have you seemingly been so shy about pushing out your own chest of your accomplishment here? Because it's remarkable what you did, but yet Rick Mears seems to be the last one to tell people about it.
I don't know. I think it's probably in from my parents and my upbringing. You know, I'm not wild about cockiness or whatever. You know, I don't necessarily like the look of it, you know, and I think in today's world they mix that up with desire a little bit too much. You know, I like to see that desire in an athlete or whatever, and sometimes I think it's kind of the other way. You know, to me it's I don't know. I'm just uncomfortable with it. I don't like tooting my own horn. The old saying, let's just put the numbers on the board. You know, let those do the talking. That's just kind of the way I always looked at it.
And I guess that's partially why, for those that have gotten your autograph before, you always sign it with thanks. Where did that start?
With the first autograph I ever had that I was ever asked for. And it was out in a desert race, and a young kid come up and, hey, can I have your autograph? And it's the first time I'd ever been asked, right? And my first thought was, well, thank you for asking. You know, and I appreciated him asking me for it. And so when I signed it, I just put thanks on it, just thanking him for asking. And it just stuck. That's where it came from.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
pretty darn
awesome.
Cool, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and I always thought it just showed that same humility, right?
And again, I think that comes from the parents, you know, mom and dad and your upbringing and that kind of thing. So it's just all part of it.
Do you remember a point when this place and this spectacle of racing slowed down for you? And does it vary for drivers how long it takes or how many entrants here it takes for the speedway to slow down, or does it ever?
It never really does. I mean, you know, when I want it to slow down, it's when I get in the car. That's when I can slow it down. You know, everything else is just, it keeps going. I was talking to somebody this morning about that. This place, the month of May, would come in, you know, and it's fairly calm and quiet the first day, especially when we were running all month, you know, a long time ago. And then every day it was just a slow gain, a gradual gain, you know, get more and more intense, more and more going on. And then by race day, it's just, you know, it's typical Indian. Everything's going crazy. But the weird part was when the next day after the race, it's just like somebody pulled the plug and it just drops again.
It's like depression, but, right?
Yeah, yeah. You don't realize how much the gain is gained until it stops.
When we come back, a Rick Mears rookie mistake that hurt his vision on Beyond the Bricks.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
In the Bet365 Command Center, welcome back to Beyond the Bricks. In 1979, Rick Mears would win the Indy 500. But a year earlier, he was a rookie.
I made up my mind. I was not going to make a mistake when I started that race. So I decided I was going to stay back in the room, stay out of the hoopla, kind of keep things calm and quiet down. And I got over here to the track, and I went into the garage and kind of stayed in the garage and kept quiet. And so in all my calmness and coolness, you know, trying to keep things quiet, I was late getting in the car. And all of a sudden, I'm kind of late.
There's your first mistake, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you know, I'm running to the car and getting in, and I'm in a hurry and I'm buckling my helmet. And I get the buckle wrong when I loop the helmet, you know, the strap back through. And I miss going around one of the loops. But I was in a rush. And usually I'd give them a couple of tugs, you know. And this one, I was late, so I just pulled it once, and it cinched up, and I jumped in and got things buckled up. Well, you know, three or four laps into the race, the window on the helmet starts raising. it's climbing up, and I'm stretching my neck trying to stay with it. Yeah, you know, I'm just trying to suck it off my helmet off my head. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, my helmet strap came undone. My first race with Roger here, and I'm thinking, I hated to make that call. You know, guys, I forgot to buckle my helmet. And so I thought, I'm going to try to see if I can go a while and catch a yellow. So I kept going, and then after about four or five laps of it trying to pull off the top of my head and not being able to see, I thought, you know, this is really dumb. I guess I've got to make a call. So I finally got the nerve to get on the radio and say, guys, my helmet came undone. I got to come in. And I think Roger made a comment, well, can you go any longer? I've already done that. But we got a yellow. The yellow came out the right time. We come in and got the bucklet and get going again. But getting in the car.
Did they rib you about it all?
Did
they say anything to you after the fact?
No. They don't do that. But Roger loves telling the story, though.
he made sure, right?
That, yeah.
And of course, you know, in that year, engine goes out. You finished 23rd. But then it was not long before success would come to you here. The one race that so many talk about, including myself, and I don't know that I've ever asked you this, is the 82 finish. You know, when Gordon Johncock wins and you're tracking him literally, nearly, you know, I mean, 10 laps out, you know, second a lap, and you're chasing him down. What's your relationship with Gordon Johncock? Do you guys talk much about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, Gordy and I have always gotten along very well. Yeah, we've always been good friends. And actually, you know, I remember it crossed my mind during the race because Gordy and I went back and forth several times throughout the race, you know, early on. And we seemed to have a little advantage on him. Every time, you know, that we were around each other, I could, you know, get a run and get by him. And but I remember thinking at one point, you know, because I know he didn't really get to enjoy his win, you know, his first win.
Yeah, with the 73 disaster and the rain and everything else.
Yeah, and I knew that. But I remember during that race watching him, and I remember at one point thinking, if we can't, you know, one of our guys can't get it done, then it would be nice if he did, if he could, just so he could see what it was really like, sure. the whole thing. And I remember that crossed my mind during the race, but then it boiled down to that battle at the end, and it was a lot of fun. It really was. I mean, at the end when I caught him and had to run at him and I couldn't quite get by him, and he pulled back a little.
It was into one, wasn't it?
Yeah, into one. What had taken place there? I got blocked from coming into pits. Whoever was in front of me stopped in the fast lane instead of pulling over in the slow lane and then stopping. And there were, you know, no speed limits back then. So he stopped in front of me, and I locked it up, and I actually hit him. But fortunately, I caught him just with the nose on the tire, and it didn't break a wing or something. But that added 2 or 3, 4 seconds to my stop. And then they had short filled on Gordy's car,
yep.
And we ended up, I didn't know it at the time, we ended up, you know, filling the car up. And so when we got down to that shootout right at the end, and I finally caught him coming to the white flag, I think. And I thought, okay, I might as well go now. Why wait? You know, and so I got a good run at him off of 4 and got beside him as we crossed the line. And I think we were almost dead heat at the line. And then he pulled back. Well, he pulled back because he was empty. He was light on fuel. And that was the speed difference. And I hadn't seen that before out of him anytime we'd been together, which is why I didn't hesitate. Had I have known that, I would have reversed it and waited to check a flag. But because people would say, well, you know, do you wish you'd have done something different? And I said, no, because what I did, I would exactly do the same thing again for what I knew. I wouldn't change it. Now, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. Yes, I would change it now after what I know and what I learned, you know. But I just kind of float around and help with whatever pops up that I might be able to help with. Another set of eyes and ears to, you know, see what's going on.
They're not like sending you out for sandwiches, right?
No. Yeah. No. Although I'd do that too if that's what's necessary, right?
Whatever it takes, right?
But yeah, no, I just kind of, you know, I don't even know where I'm going to watch from yet. I may go up on top of the, you know, the pagoda with Roger to start with and watch the first part of it. And then maybe migrate down to the garage.
And you want to come out in 3 and spot for me?
No, too many steps these days for these legs.
You were spotting up there in 3 for a number of years,
yeah,
right?
It was a lot of fun. It was fun up there. I enjoyed it.
It
enjoyed the spotting. And it was great, you know, seeing everybody out there every year and getting involved. But these days, that's a long climb. Getting a little older these days.
Way up there. But you know what? It was always fun to watch when you would climb the steps for spotting. I always knew when you were on your way, because that entire Northeast Vista and the grandstands, it was like the wave. Everybody would stand up to give the proper due, because if you're not going to recognize it, Rick Mears, the rest of the race fans are, and that is the greatness that is the 4-time runner.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, we appreciate you coming by. Certainly enjoy it, right? And you guys are going to have, I think, a good day on Sunday. So far, so good.
It should be a fun race. I tell you, there are so many cars so close these days. It's going to be very interesting, I think.
It's incredible. I mean, no question about it. When you look at the McLarens and you look at, obviously, you know, and you never know what those Ganassi Hondas can do if they can work their way up.
Absolutely.
So, Rick, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rick Mears, 1979, 1984 in that Pennzoil, 1988 scheme, 1991, the 4-time winner of the Indianapolis 500.
Rick Mears had said when it comes down to it, it's just about results and numbers, and they are there. 15 Indy 500 starts, 5 poles, and 4 wins. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network said of him in 1991, Rick Mears, the master. I'm Jake Query. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you are ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.